This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Deeney.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travelled to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast would not happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to become a socio, to become one of our members, and get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. So go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter, patreon.com/Graham Hunter, and we'll bring you joy.
Hi, lovely listeners. The Big Interview was fortunate enough to be in the grand leather-clad dungeons of the Hotel Duvan in Harrogate approximately 12 hours after Adrienne made a howler for Liverpool against Atletico out of the European Cup. Unfortunately, our guest today, Paul Robinson, who analyses what's going through a keeper's fevered mind when he kicks the ball straight to an opponent instead of making an obvious pass or lumping it out of the stadium. Listen on to try and understand the life of a lonely goalkeeper. Paul Robinson is funny, articulate. He's part of a family that is extremely sports talented. And he shared his time with The Big Interview because he's loved listening to our work. And you're going to enjoy hearing this characterful, forthright, very intelligent new friend of The Big Interview telling you about his life, starting with the maddest man in football, John Budgie Burridge, and how he saw Tony Yeboah's thunderblaster for Leeds going into the net at Elland Road. Here comes Paul. Part one, at least. Part two of Paul Robinson, just as good, will be right along in a couple of days. The Big Interview's back. Paul, welcome to The Big Interview. We've just been talking off camera about our socio, Tom Lee, who persuaded both of us to meet. So I want to say right now, thanks, Tom. Fantastic. Nice to meet you.
And you. Thank you for having me.
The surroundings that you know very well. We're down in the snog, aren't we?
The Hotel Duvan in Harrogate, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a regular meeting place for me and the rest of my family.
Tell you what.
Use it quite often.
When I moved to Harrogate, I think I might be jockeying with you for the Christmas Day booking. It's sensational. And we could have met up last night, it turns out, but we didn't because I was too shy to phone you for a pint.
Yeah.
But we were doing the same thing. We were watching the Champions League, a competition which has to be close to your heart because of how you began in it, and we'll come to that later. But analytically, watching Liverpool go out to an Atleti side which, in my view, played as alert and as snappishly and with as much concentration as they have all season. But in my view, they were going to be well beaten. And at 2-0, it looked like Liverpool would either hold or add. And then the world falls apart. Now, You must look at what Adrian did for Atleti's first goal, and analytically, you must have strong views on it. For an idiot like me, who's never kept goal, and who's lived in Spain, where they're always coaching you about having a look before the ball comes to you in any passing situation, not just goalkeepers, and also the gift of peripheral vision. What do you imagine was going through Adrian's head, hypothetically, or what? When you look at that, what do you see when a goalkeeper doesn't look left, Milner's available, neither does he lump it out of the ground, which was an option, and the ball goes straight to an opponent? When you're watching that, what emotions are you feeling? And analytically, how do you sort of break down what happened there?
You can see he was caught in about three different minds. He's a goalkeeper at the moment who's playing with a massive lack of confidence. You see him in the Premier League the way he is. He's been beaten by shots that he should have saved. There's a lot of balls that come off him, as you saw again last night, in and around his body. He's not comfortable with his hands. He's blocking stuff. He's not getting it out of the box. He made a double save last night, but the first save, he should have dealt with it a lot better. He should have held it, made a decent recovery with it. But as you say, the kick, he's not confident. He's been told to play out from the back. He's not Alisson. He can't play out from the back as well as Alisson can. It's not something that Adrian's done throughout his career. He's never been asked to do it in a team like Liverpool. When he came in first time for Alisson, I thought he did okay. Thought he did reasonably well. Mm-hmm. But he's playing in a team that was playing very well. They were keeping clean sheets. They were winning games. Now all of a sudden he's come back in. The team's hit a little bit of not a blip, but in their season, they're not winning games. They're first time, they're struggling to get results. They're letting goals in. And he's been questioned. And you can see that was on his mind last night. Teams are seeing that. They're hitting shots from distance. They're testing him. And they're making it like a weak point, if you like, and trying to exploit that. But last night when the ball came back to him, you could see he wanted to play because that's what he's been told to play. But at the same time, you could see that he couldn't pick a pass. And he wanted to get rid of it. He wanted to kick it down the field. But in the back of his mind, the manager told him not to do that. So he's caught between two minds. And in the end, he ends up doing nothing. But then he gets back in position, which he's not in a decent... he's not in a bad position for the shot.
Yeah.
He's a couple of yards off his line. But then just as he's about to hit the shot, he jumps off the ground. You see him, you look at the replay. He's about that far off the ground.
Should we stop there so that people who've watched it but have never kept goal or thought about goalkeeping?
Yeah.
One, why is that bad? Two, once he'd got himself recovered and he knows the ball's coming back at him, what should he be doing?
Well, he should be feet in contact with the ground. Listen, I've done it as a goalkeeper as well, and you watch other goalkeepers in the Premier League doing it now. It's a natural, to get yourself set, you kind of had a little jump, but some goalkeepers have a tendency to jump higher than others. And Adrian last night, when he went to set, he was about that far off the ground. So when the ball struck that far off the ground...
You're not moving, are you?
The way that the ball travels now, it's 15 yards closer to him. You look at it and it went two yards into the corner of the goal, like into the middle of the goal, and you think, he's got to save that. But when you actually look at it, he didn't give himself a chance of saving it because his feet weren't in contact with the ground. He couldn't move towards the ball.
Is that a nervous thing? Is it like a tick?
Sometimes, yeah, as goalkeepers do. You've got a set position that you want to get into. His position off his line, cut 2-3 yards off his line. He recovered to a good position.
No,
but then he went to set himself, and with his feet not in contact with the ground, he couldn't get there. And I think he was beaten, to be fair, in all three goals last night. I think he could have done better with them all. Mm. I think the second one was pretty much the same with his feet off the ground. And then the third one was strange. I've watched it a couple of times. And it kind of goes through him in a one-on-one. Mm-hmm. I think the difference between the two teams last night, if it was a boxing match, it had been stopped by a long way because Liverpool were outstanding.
I thought it was more than, in terms of pound for pound, it was more than a 2-0 margin.
Oh, at Liverpool, first half should have been. But I thought Oblak was outstanding. I think he's a brilliant goalkeeper. I think he's a top-class goalkeeper. Mm. And as I say, if it was a boxing match, Liverpool would have won it. They stopped it. But the difference, real difference between the two teams was Oblak and Adrian, the two goalkeepers. If Alisson was in goal for Liverpool last night, I genuinely believe they wouldn't have lost that game.
And, you know, did you see what I saw? So you've talked about Adrian having a split mind about what he'd like to do, what he thinks he should be doing. Also, the noise, the pressure in your head. Milner, as the ball is beginning to come towards Adrian from the pass back, Milner's putting himself in position, so it's easier for an outfield player. He's read it. I struggle to understand, but there'll be a reason, whether it's just crowd noise or adrenaline, but he didn't take a look left. Because if he even thought, well, I should be playing it, you just take it onto your right, a quarter turn, off it goes to Milner, and away they go. And effectively, I think at that moment, you pass to Milner and Liverpool are in the next round.
It's just, it's a goalkeeper that's lacking in confidence. Clearly not playing as well as he should be, or wanting to be playing.
Which gives you muddled thoughts.
And straight away, you're thinking, he's trying to do things that he maybe shouldn't be doing, or he just gets caught in two minds. And you feel for him, because when you're in that situation, it doesn't go right. If you do that, 9 times out of 10, it goes to one of your players, you get away with it. When you're, for want of a better phrase, when you're having one, it goes to one of their players and they stick it in the corner. And then it snowballs from there. But as you say, if it was Alisson in goal, he gets it, opens himself out to James Milner. And I think if that first one wouldn't have gone in, the other two probably wouldn't have done either. No.
When you're beginning, right, because we've talked about, you know, we were grimacing last night watching the football where there was a pass across the penalty area. Now, I'm significantly older than you, but that was like verboten. You know, school teachers and coaches would have put you in the jail if you passed across the penalty area.
Passing in the penalty area, even now the rules have changed, so you can pass in the penalty area as a goalkeeper. So
what was life like as a young goalkeeper? What was the differences then, thinking, well, I've got talent, people like me, I'm going to be a goalkeeper? You know, from then to now, what were the things that were going on then that are unrecognisable now?
I just used to love playing football. I used to be a decent outfield player as well. I used to play in goal for the sixth form at school when I went to secondary school. In my first year at secondary school, as a year seven, I'd play in goal for the sixth form and I'd play outfield for my own age. And I always used to say, I used to laugh, there was only one thing that stopped me from being a centre forward, and it was about 2.5 stone at the time.
Well, you had to put it on.
I think
we all know that's what.
But no, it got to the point where it was a stick to what you're good at, and goalkeeping was always something that I enjoyed. But as you say, it's changed so much unrecognisably over the years, as the game has as well. It was a job of catching crosses, saving shots, and then kicking the ball down the pitch as far as you can.
As far as you possibly can.
And jumping forward a little bit. When I went to Leeds as an apprentice at 16, I was third of three when I left school to go as an apprentice. And an opportunity came with John Burridge, who was my goalie coach at the time. Oh, how long have you got? There's a bundle of stories on
Budgie. I worked with Budgie.
But anyway, Budgie took me on loan. He said, you're soft as shit, you need toughening up. He took me to Durham City on loan in the Northern League. I had to go and live with Budgie and his missus for 3 months. And he toughened me up by taking me to Durham City, and they loved me because I could kick it the length of the pitch.
How many sit-ups did he make you do per day?
Mate, I'll tell you a story about when we used to go to Newcastle's training ground, and he used to train at university. And I think at the time he was banned from the training ground. So he'd have me up at half five in the morning, running through Durham City, set a bag of balls on his back, jumping over the fence in the corner, running over the canal at the back, training on one of the back pitches before anyone else would get in and see him, and then going back to his house.
Let's tell people who this is. This is John Budgie Burridge.
Yeah.
He was part of that team of the 80s, was part of Crystal Palace. He's played for just about every club in Britain, including my own beloved Aberdeen.
Goalkeeper of Man City, wasn't he? Something like that.
And as he rightly says, there was a stage where he was very, very good indeed. He was a really good goalkeeper. Yeah. I mean, I remember him when he was young, fearless, you know, one of the breed of smaller goalkeepers, but flying about his goal.
Passionate, absolutely obsessed.
Relatively confident.
Yeah, you could say that. He wasn't shy, let's put it that way.
But, like, to this day, like, I was at the Clásico the other week, commentating with Simon Hanley, Michael Laudrup by our side, and as part of our team, the Facebook group was Kev Campbell, Tim Lee, and co-commentator as well, was Budgie, and Budgie was at the Clásico in his goalkeeping.
He gets places that water couldn't get, mate, honestly. What was Budgie doing there?
He's commentating on the game for Facebook in the Middle East region. He wears his goalie gloves all the time still now.
Honestly, mate, nice guy, wrong planet. He's wired to the moon. He is brilliant.
I don't think he'd deny that either.
No, he wouldn't. He'd tell you exactly the same. I mean, he used to come to Leeds and coach us as kids, and he used to turn up, I mean, car boots full of like gear and sell all the t-shirts and stuff at the back of his car. The gaffer at the time said, Budgie, you can't do that. You're going to have to stop doing that. He was just...
Well, now, for the people that don't believe me, when I was best man at my best mate, and the stag was in Hexham, so we went to Hexham races.
Yeah.
And we're staying at Slaley Hall. And on the Saturday at Hexham races, I wouldn't call it the grandstand, but there's a sort of barn at Hexham. I love Hexham, so I'm not knocking it. There's a sort of grandstand. And look, up on the roof, there's this sort of figure in a long Crocodile Dundee leather coat, a mad Crocodile Dundee hat, snakeskin cowboy boots. And he's up there, and it's a good height. And Why he's gone up there, I don't know, but he's just won the league with Blyth Spartans, I think, as player manager.
Yeah.
And he's threatening to jump off. His players have bet him that he won't jump off the grandstand. Really, this day, I think he tried to lift his coat out
to get some wings and air under his wings.
Honestly, that
doesn't surprise me with him. With some of the stories that we had with him, he was honestly.
And you get to live
but
with
his,
him.
His heart is so genuine. Yeah. He's just so passionate about football. You read stories about him, you know, having fruit thrown around the room to catch fruit, and his missus throwing stuff around. And everything you read about him that you think, God, that can't be true, is 100% true.
And more.
He's as mad as a box of frogs, but he is one of the nicest, most genuine people, passionate people, and he helped me so much in my career.
Did he change your perception or ability or attitude?
Attitude, he made me grow up quickly as a man. I left home at 16 to be an apprentice for £37 a week. To live in Diggs. We were the first lot that lived on the training ground at Leeds with these new state-of-the-art training grounds. And then all of a sudden you're training with the first team because you're a goalkeeper. There's obviously a small number, so you get put in with the first team, with the first team goalie coach. And that was a baptism of fire straight away with Budgie. These sessions were sharp, lively, hard. You could not have a day off with him.
No.
We'd start an hour and a half before everybody else in the gym playing head tennis. He'd be sweating like a bull mastiff before he'd even gone out. Going up for headers at the head tennis net, it'd be like sticking elbows on me, the other kids, and the competitiveness and the passion and the will to win.
That's something
and
that's the drive. Good to learn, isn't it?
It was so infectious, It's so old school, and it's probably, well, half of the stuff that Budgie used to do, you wouldn't get away with in the modern world now.
Yeah.
But it was just such a good grounding.
And, like, so you were born locally, so when you get that first clutch of talented boys living at the training ground, more or less, that has to feel at that stage already like a dream come true.
It was strange. It was odd leaving home at that age.
Where was home? Beverley?
Beverley. I was born in Beverley, yeah.
Which, for those who don't know, is there's an lovely race course there too.
Yeah, East Yorkshire.
It's within, you know, touching distance of where you had to move to.
45 minutes, an hour to Leeds.
Yeah.
My dad used to take me two nights a week to train it at the training ground. And then obviously the time came to be whether you're going to be an apprentice or not. We had a successful youth team. Up from like 14s, 15s, 16s. And then the time came, one of the nights at training, you went in for a meeting with your parents. And if you basically, it was a yes or a no as to whether you were going to be offered an apprenticeship with the promise of a pro or a one-year apprenticeship, because you can only sign a pro when you're 17. Yeah. So it was either a one-year apprenticeship and two-year pro or a two-year apprenticeship and a year pro. And the lads that came out with the tracksuit under their arm were the lads that were in. The lads that came out without weren't. Unfortunately, I was one of the ones that did.
Was it an intoxicating feeling? What did Leeds matter to you as a club?
Yeah, because I was there for so long.
As you're growing up, I mean, what's your first experience of Elland Road? Who are the players you remember? What was happening at the club before you know that you're a talented footballer? Are Leeds United a big deal in your life?
I remember ball boying because I used to go and watch Hull City as a kid. My granddad used to take me to watch Hull City. And it's at the time Grimsby Town were in a higher league. I think they were in Division 1 or 2 at the time. So the weeks that Hull City were away, we'd maybe go and watch Grimsby. Leeds were always the top team, but they were just that little bit too far out the area and we never got to go there. But when I joined the academy there, we could be ball boy for all the home games. So as a kid, you got to watch, you know, the likes of Gary McAllister, Gordon Strachan, John Lukic was the goalkeeper at that time. And as it progressed and the team got better under Howard Wilkinson, the likes of Tony Yeboah came in. And I was ball boy for that game. You know, the Liverpool game, the volley. If you watch that game very, very closely, as he hits the volley, there's some spotty little adolescent kid in a very, very pastel blue top with great big yellow lapels by the side of the goal who does that.
Having shouted, shoot!
And that's me. And the irony is, it's David James that was in goal, who I went on to take his England place. And I was sat ball boying behind the goal for that Tony Yeboah goal.
We've done one of these interviews with James Milner.
Yeah.
Who was ball boy, I think, on... I think probably the night of the Barcelona game, I think.
Right.
At any rate, he was a ball boy. Nowadays, ball boys are the sort of 12th man.
Yeah.
Because what you see is, it's like basketball court.
Well, you look at Liverpool last night as well. You saw the way that the ball boys, when they were chasing the game, all of a sudden the ball boys got ammunition supplied to them. As soon as the ball went out, it was back in. But there, when I was ball boy, it was just a case of crouch behind the hoardings and just get the ball back if it comes to you.
No instructions, nothing fly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if they were 1-0 up with 5 minutes to go, the manager would come out and tell the youth team coach, you'd drag him down, and the youth team coach, you could see him walking around the pitch and knew what was coming. just slow down a bit, lads.
Lose the ball. Lose the ball.
If that ball comes near you, do not get up. Just let it go.
And like, with the first time you ball boy, does it feel pressurised? Do you feel the eyes in the back of your head when you're sitting with the crowd behind you?
It's the first time you really get to be amongst the crowd. It's the first time you're actually down there. Okay, you go and watch football, you've seen a lot of football, but it's the first time you actually think, whoa, this is what the players feel like. This is what it's like to be at this level. And I don't know whether it's consciously or subconsciously that they do that with the academy boys, because my boy's in the academy at Leeds now, and they do exactly the same. And he absolutely loves going on a Saturday or a Wednesday, whenever it is, to ball boy for the first team. And whether it's just to give the lads a little bit of a taste or just a bit of an experience. But when you're there, I mean, you learn so many new words as well. He's come back the first few times that he's come back. Dad, what's this?
What, Czech or Italian or Portuguese?
Yes, yeah, all that kind of
old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon.
Very, very old-fashioned Anglo-Saxon from the cop at the end. Because he's a goalkeeper as well, he gets put behind the goals. So he gets to hear all the choice words. Dad, I heard this today. Can I say it? I said, well, say it quick and I'll let you know. So no, it's good, but as I say,
a proper education.
That's the time as a kid you get your first real taste of it.
Do you get a couple of quid in a Mars bar, or what's the story?
I think you used to get a Mars bar at half time, or a bag of crisps or something, and a hot drink. But it was just I think your parents got a ticket for taking you, and you got
nice.
And it's pretty much the same now. That's exactly how it is now. Been that part of the club, and then as you grow, you obviously become an apprentice. I got a taste of going into the club early, because as one of the so-called better youngsters, if you like, they'll bring you in on school holidays. So I used to go to Ellen Road as a youngster, like sometimes Alan Smith, Jonathan Woodgate, my era, that two or three of us would go in on school holidays, and we'd join the apprentices who were changing the away team dressing room, or at Fulham Park, the changing rooms at the top, and you'd be doing jobs with them, what they do jobs for the first team, where basically they'd make you do their jobs. And that's the first time you really got a feel of you were around the first thing. That's the first time you actually feel like you a football, if you know what I mean.
This is me.
Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And all of this prepares you quite well for 1997 against Crystal Palace, because that's a sparkling little side that you have that, you know, before your career's even begun, you're an FA Cup winner, which is...
That's one way to look at it, yeah.
It's a fact.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It must have felt for the city, because everybody obviously wants the first team, whatever city you're attached to win. But there's a deep love of our kids are coming. There are quality kids.
Yeah.
At every club, that whisper, next generation, don't worry, the kids are brilliant. And your group was extremely good, eh? And you beat Crystal Palace in the final. But I don't know how you get to the final, or what that whole thing feels like. And I also don't understand, because I don't think Alan Smith plays in the final, or I don't think he's in that group, because you and Harry Kewell are.
Yeah, Maybury. I think Alan Smith was. I'm not sure. Maybe because he's a bit younger than me, Smudge, so he might.
Yeah.
I can't remember the team. Woodgate did. Kewell, Maybury. They're a strong team. Really strong team that year. And we were that strong again. We got to the semi-final again the next year without the older, because we were the first generation. We were like the first years. And without the second years, we got to the semi-final again the year after.
Paul Robinson, Alan Maybury, Jonathan Woodgate, Damien Lynch, Harry Kewell. Kevin Dixon, Tommy Narvik. Stephen McPhail could play a little bit.
What a great player.
What a
fantastic player.
Yeah. Wesley Boyle, Matthew Jones, Lee Matthews, Stuart Gore, and Alan Smith.
Sub. Yeah, because he wasn't an apprentice at that time. He was a year younger than us. So Smudger was still at school. He was still a schoolboy. Because we were the first years, and he was the next lot coming up. But he was that good, he got put up into the team with us. But as you say, it was a great generation to play in. We had such a strong team. Paul Hart was the manager, and he had a guy with him called Robin Ray and Eddie Gray.
Hero of mine.
Paul Hart used to put the fear of God into us with just the way that he was. With kids, he was brilliant looking back in hindsight, but you had to toe the line with him. The jobs had to be spot on, the performance had to be spot on, your fitness, the running, everything, in an old school way but a modern way of thinking. But no, so with the jobs and that side of things, we lived on site, so it wasn't, he never used to let you go back to your rooms until the jobs were checked.
Yeah,
you had a gaffer. In the second years, there was a gaffer, and he was in charge of going around. One of the boys, like the captain, and he was in charge of going around checking all the jobs, making sure all the jobs were done.
So in other words, he was chief sneak.
If the jobs weren't done, no, he was the one that got it off Paul Hart. If the jobs weren't done, he'd be in the office, done, and then he'd have to give it to the lads. If the jobs weren't done or anything wasn't up to scratch, then if Paul Hart came down from the offices, take cover, he knew what was coming. But it was a discipline, and it was, he knew what a talent we had, and we had a team. We had played in the Northern Intermediate League. I remember my first year there, we lost one game that year in the league. That was it. We lost 1-0 at home to Sunderland. I still remember it to this day. At home, first game, it was about first five or six games of the season. And what used to happen is we used to play on a Saturday morning, and all our parents used to come up. Mm. And then, obviously not the Irish boys or the international boys, but our parents would take us home after the game on a Saturday, and then we'd have to be back in the digs for 8 o'clock on the Sunday night. So you got Saturday afternoon, good Sunday enough. At home and back. And we lost 1-0 at home. It wasn't a lack of effort, work hard. It was just one of them things. But he didn't think that. He wasn't happy. Well, we didn't perform. Don't accept defeat. This wasn't good enough. That wasn't good enough. By the way, none of you are going home tonight. To which he opened the door and told all the parents that they can all depart because none of the lads are coming home tonight. They've got jobs to do. Sunday morning up at the training ground, running around the training ground. Hence the reason we never lost another game for the rest of the season.
So I suppose I should really ask, seriously, when you make your league debut,
yeah,
against Chelsea,
yeah,
who was man of the match? Let's not mess about here. Who carried the champagne away at the end?
Was it me?
I think we both know it was. You were ready, is what I would say, because Nigel's ribs weren't right.
Yeah.
It's Chelsea, a decent Chelsea side, yeah. A good one. You made a lovely save from Laudrup, if I remember rightly, but your man in the match. To what extent does the formation that you've had mixed with your ability help you dominate a situation where I think you're 18 or 19, maybe 18, I can't remember.
Yeah,
18.
Or maybe just, yeah.
And you're up against a right good side and you win man of the match and you treat it as if, you know, I remember you saying you were nervous, but you treat it as if you were a long-time pro. The formation adds as much to that occasion, I guess, as the ability.
Well, I've been training with the first team a while. I've been in and around the first team. And as you say, Nigel did his ribs, but at that time I was third choice goalkeeper. Mark Beeney was number two. And he was obviously not match sharp because he's not played, because if Nigel's fit, he plays. And it'd been a long run of games for him. So I think midweek that week, there was a reserve game. And Mark Beeney said, you know what, I'll play in that. I'll get myself right, or, you know, just get myself ready for the weekend. And then he ruptured his Achilles midweek. And then all of a sudden, from me thinking, great, I'm going to be sat on the bench watching the first team Chelsea, this is a great experience for me, all of a sudden it becomes real that there's a potentially they're going to be playing. I think they tried to get a goalkeeper in an emergency loan because I was so young at that time, because of what had happened to the two goalkeepers. But it just got to the end of the week and it was a case of, look, you're going to be playing. So it was great. I was very nervous, apprehensively looking forward to it. As you say, against a very, very good Chelsea side. Difficult day as well. I remember it was sunny, it was windy, it was raining. It was one of them days where you got all the seasons in one day. I always remember the first 5 or 10 minutes, it was a corner. I might have made a save or it had gone wide or something. Went to get the ball. Dennis Wise comes running in, picks the ball up and he goes, I'm swinging this right in on top of your head and you're going to get smashed. So you're thinking straight away, boy, here we go. This is great. Loved it.
That's definitely what you thought first thing.
Yeah, loved it.
Because not every reacts to Dennis or words like that.
But that's
way.
A challenge. That's a challenge thrown down to you. So straight away, you're like, come on then.
Bring it on.
Yeah, I'll get this one. This is mine. Or, but you have to be careful not to be sucked in to make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very good gamesmanship and good mind games from him. Because obviously, as a youngster, he thinks, right, going to draw him out now or make him do something that he wouldn't want to do.
There'd been a tumult because the focus was on you coming in there.
Yeah.
And you get a handful of games well in advance of your breakthrough. But what was the club like then? Because George had arrived and made Leeds really competitive, in my view. Helped nick the title off Arsenal in a big, big result at the end of the season. And I suppose George, Gunnar George... in Leeds, I think initially might not have been all that welcome, but he'd made the side really powerful, I thought.
Yeah.
Full of good talent as well. But there'd been a tumult all season about whether he was leaving or going, whether Martin O'Neill was coming in.
That's right, yeah, Martin O'Neill was touted for a long time.
And David O'Leary was the choice eventually of Peter Ridsdale. What was that, as an observer, what was that like?
You don't really forge an opinion as a youngster because you're kind of carried away with what's, you know, around you. You're happy to be a part of it. You don't. George Graham was a figure, somebody like Paul Hart, ruled with respect, aura, and he was a dominant figure, if you like, the aggressor, not an aggressor, but somebody who ruled with a very strong opinion. And you just, as a youngster, you have to respect that. And you don't really forge them. You're just happy to be part of the squad, training every day. And me at that age, being given my opportunity, being given my chance in the first team, whether it was for 2 games, 5 games, 10 games, whatever it was a ride that I was just happy to be on. But it was one of them at that age, you know it's coming to an end, so you're not disappointed for when you come out of the team. It was kind of a, done that now. It was kind of a relief when you came out.
Assimilate, start, build up again.
I've done that now. I've proved I can do that now. I'm still very, very young, but I've been in, I've done it, I've proved I can do it. Which, flipping forward, was different the second time I went in, because I got 20-odd games and I got pulled out, and then I saw my arse, spat my dummy out and wanted to leave, because you think you can do it over a longer period of time. But at that time, the club, as you say, it was going through managerial transition. As I say, as a youngster, you don't really get involved with that.
Paint me some pictures then, because we've lost some of these characters a wee bit, you like. So, for example, you wouldn't have dealt with him often, but Peter Ridsdale,
yeah.
Did you deal with him?
Yeah.
What was he like?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's a man who followed his dream. Absolutely followed his dream. A passionate Leeds United fan. There's, you know, you talk about the gross mismanagement, the overspending. He followed his dream. He financed that club to almost the point of ultimate glory, the European title, which he wanted to achieve. He was always on side for the players. He'd travel away with us. And he was a man who was just very, very passionate about his football club, about his managers, about his players. And we'd have European nights, we'd have away trips, we'd go, we'd get a result in Europe. The manager will say, right, we'll have dinner together, we'll have a couple of glasses of wine in the bar together tonight, knock it on the head at midnight, bed, we'll have a couple of glasses of wine, a bit of a sing-song. And he was there, he was with us, and he was part of the group. I've got a lot of respect for the man. You know, there's questions over whether it was his fault, the way that the club was grossed in mismanagement, whether he was wrongly advised or however that came about. But at the time and the bubble that you're in, it was one hell of a bandwagon to be on.
That's interesting that you describe it, that bubble you're in, because a lot of clubs or a lot of groups of players wouldn't have found time for the money man being in there. It would have been hard for a non-football person to have been accepted in.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, in a lot of places, he'd have been laughed at behind his back about having, yeah. Oh, he wants to be one of... And footballers are a tight clan.
But it was a tight clan, but we were a wider clan, because they would travel together with, like, when we went to Europe, you know, the European nights that we experienced in the Champions League, we'd travel together on a plane. They'd charter a plane for us, but there'd be the manager, the chairman, the staff... the press, some of the press would come with us, then there'd be the directors, and then there'd be like a corporate trip. Leeds United had a travel company at that time, Leeds United Travel. My dad and Jonathan Woodgate's dad travelled Europe in the best style that they've ever been in. They went to every game. My dad and Woody's dad never missed a game. They'll tell you the nights in Rome at the San Siro, different places. And that was all thanks to Ridsdale's vision and what he wanted to do for the club. And it was one big family, and it was a big extended family. And it wasn't one of these teams or clubs that the players were inaccessible. The players were always accessible. We didn't get on a private jet just for the players. There'd be a corporate trip with us behind us as well.
That matters.
All right, we may as well go through a different channel at the airport, or we don't go the same way, or we get off a plane and we get on a bus and go to the hotel. There's levels of privacy and security that a team need, but it was one big Leeds United family at that time, and as I say, it was a bandwagon that was phenomenal to be on, and you didn't realise what was going on. Nobody at that time, from a player's point of view, we're thinking about finances, we're thinking about money, thinking how the hell is the club affording to do this, or why are you doing this? I mean, you were on great bonuses for the Champions League, you were on bonuses per point in the Champions League, wages were good, everybody was happy. There was no kind of foresight 3 years down the line. Well, what if this hits the buffers? What if this comes off the rails?
No. It's not your job under any stretch of the imagination.
Looking back, I don't know if it was anybody's job. I don't know if anybody had done that. Do you know what I mean? But saying about Peter Ridsdale, and I genuinely think he was a businessman, a chairman, but at heart, a real supporter who followed his dream and lived his dream to almost an inch of making it.
European Cup semi-final.
Yeah, Valencia.
As every reveller who's ever had a big night says, when the consequences come home the next day, it was a hell of a ride.
Yeah.
And again, paint a little picture, if you will. Pick somebody, because I noticed that as you're coming in at first, Lucas Radebe is around.
Yeah.
People talk about him as an exceptional character. I have to ask you about the Haaland-Keane feud. Starts just before you debut. It starts around about the time that you're winning the Youth Cup against Crystal Palace. But you get to know Alfing Haaland, who has this notorious feud with Keane, whose boy now already is just about the number one exciting...
He's going to be a superstar.
Striking prospect
superstar
in the world.
Yeah.
I don't know about which of them, but tell us about some of the characters there. The people who stand out for you, the 18, 19, 20-year-old Paul Robinson, who's like, this geezer's different.
Lucas was different. As you pointed out, Lucas, you call him the chief. He was so laid back, he could fall over. Nothing fazed him. His ability to read a game. He played with so many injuries. His knees were hanging off. His ankles, he was struggling every week. But to play at the level that he did and the ability that he had. And he was always one, there was... At that time, it was a very jovial dressing room, and there was a definite pecking order. And as a youngster, you come in and, you make the teas. Back in them days, you make the teas. When you get on the team bus on the way home, you get everybody's dinner on the way home. You clean the bus after on the way home.
Even as a first-team player?
If you just start and you're just coming into the first team, if you're the youngest on the bus, mate, you're making cups of tea and getting the dinner in. And that's how it was. But Lucas would be one of these that, no, you're all right, I'll get it, don't worry. Or he'd be at the back giving you a hand. Do you know, he was nothing. There was no ego, no side to him or anything. He'd like, Chief, do you want a brew? He said, I'll come and do it, that kind of thing. He was just a genuinely nice man. He wasn't a stereotypical footballer, but his ability on the pitch now, looking back, was phenomenal. There was big characters in that team. I mean, the Gary Kelly is a huge, huge character. One of my good friends, even now, Ian Hart, left back. The quality that we had in that team.
Smashing use of the ball.
Big for Dukes up front. Harry Kewell, Lee Bowyer. There was a lot of talent, but a lot of characters in that team. And then you brought the likes of Rio Ferdinand into that later on, when the club was getting stronger. The dressing room was a tough school. Jason Wilcox as well, very, very big character. There was a lot of big characters fighting for status, and it was a very, very tough school to come into.
Then on that subject, we've got a sponsor, it's Bet365, and they want to know, who's the best central defender you played behind? But all the top quality footballers.
There's a lot.
And but it's got to be a personal thing for you.
There's a lot.
Hierarchically, one may be better than the other, but for you.
I love playing with Ledley King. A lot's been made out of Ledley with his injuries and the way that he didn't train. That's not true. He did train, but he trained in a different way. He had his problems with his knees, but he would train in the gym. He'd do his rehab. If you could get him on the grass on a Thursday or Friday before a Saturday, if he trained fully during the week in and week out, he would have been a top class player. Just his ability to read the ball, to read the game, and he could play as well. I remember a couple of times Martin Yole played him in a holding midfield role, and I thought he was fantastic in that holding midfield role. The time that I spent with Ledley at Spurs and in the England setup, you could see what quality he had. But it was a tough, really tough question. I mean, John Terry, Jonathan Woodgate, Rio Ferdinand, Sol Campbell, Lucas Radebe. Really, really tough selection. A lot of centre-half to choose from. Not many bad ones in that list, to be fair.
No, and mentality unites them, because you'd say John Terry and, say, Jonathan Woodgate were different kind of footballers.
Yeah.
Probably Rio and Sol, different again. How much they liked the ball, what they wanted to do, positionally. Do they go first to the ball, or are they reading and looking after the second challenge, or whatever? But I think strength of character and winning mentality probably unites them.
Yeah, absolutely. And centre-halves have that. And obviously I've been lucky enough to play with a lot of good centre-halves, but very, very different ones. Ball-playing centre-halves, defending centre-halves. JT was probably the ultimate put-your-body-on-the-line, literally die-for-the-cause type centre-half, whereas Rio, he's got that in him, but he's a more elegant centre-half, quicker, gets himself out of trouble, ball-plays. I think Rio was probably one of the first centre-halves, but real ball-playing centre-halves, who wants to get, rather than just kick the ball down the field, wants to get on the ball and play. But no, I was fortunate. My first ever roommate was a centre-half when I was a kid, coming into the first team squad at Leeds. I roomed with David Witherall, if you remember David Witherall.
Yeah.
And he was a soft option to break the young lad into the team, because he was such a nice guy, really placid, wouldn't have a bad word to say about anybody. He wouldn't go cutting my shoes up while I was asleep or playing any pranks on me. So I think it was a safe bet. But Weathers was just so straight down the middle. It's like, get into the room, do you want a cup of tea or anything? No, no, I'm fine. Like, lights, he'd be watching telly and then he'd turn the lights off at 9 o'clock and just say good night. And I'm laid there like a kid, like, Weathers, it's 9 o'clock, but you don't say anything, I don't do anything. I just remember laying there for a little while. But no, he's
quite firm on the pitch,
guy.
I thought.
Yeah, very good, very good centre half. Scored the goal for Bradford, I think, that put Leeds in the Champions League.
Yeah.
But no, he's another character that wasn't a stereotypical footballer, as you can see by the job he's doing now. Is it the Football Association or the Premier League, whoever he's working for? Very knowledgeable, very clever guy.
Were you a talker to your centre halves? Did you hector them?
Yeah. Hugely believed in it. Hugely believed in it. If you can handle the troops in front of you, if you can make them do their job, or if you can make them work harder, it cuts your workload down. The harder you work to pull their strings, to keep them away from your goal, the less you have to do. And footballers love an excuse, and they love a little bit of downtime, and they love a relax and a switch off. But if you're constantly in their ear and they constantly hear your voice, they just think, oh, I'll have a breather for 5 seconds. But if you're in their ear, they won't.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.